Hello, everyone. This is Tracy Shoster, and today I'll be reading from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for the week of Sunday, August 11th, 2019. First up, from the Arts section, Disney's Haunted Mansion at 50. The ghosts are still grinning. Superfans share their memories of this macabre but delightful Disneyland attraction. One summer visit to Disneyland after another, a young Tom Morris stood outside a mysterious set of locked gates, peering up at a stately old-fashioned manor sitting just out of reach and wondering what awaited inside. When those gates in Anaheim, California finally opened in August 1969, Mr. Morris and others entered what became one of the most beloved and long-lasting attractions at any of the Disney theme parks. The Haunted Mansion, a macabre ride filled with mystifying illusions, eerie inhabitants, and 999 grim, grinning ghosts having a delightful time in the afterlife. For Mr. Morris, who later became an Imagineer, a Disney employee who designs resort attractions, every element of the dark ride was fascinating. There was something about the music, the theme song, Grim Grinning Ghosts, plays throughout the ride, the smell of the hydraulics, the old-fashioned showmanship. He took a spin through the mansion twice, each trip, a rare sign of dedication back when two rides at Disney required two separate tickets, and he found himself doodling pictures of the ride in class. Surely, Mr. Morris thought, he was the only one with this level of adoration for the Haunted Mansion. 50 years later, it's clear that has never been the case. The Haunted Mansion, treasured as one of Disney's quirkier rides, has long maintained a fan-favorite status for its distinct balance of the spooky and the sprightly. Varying iterations of the attraction, including the Dutch Gothic-style Tudor version at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida, have become staples at 5 Disney resorts around the world. Other rides over the years have come and gone and been given facelifts to reflect recent Disney films. But with remarkably little deviation from the original design, the mansion has been a constant for 5 decades. Built in the early 1960s to resemble an old New Orleans estate, the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland sat vacant for years. Its exterior finished, its insides a mystery. The longer it sat, the more the mystique built. An advertisement at the gate for post-lifetime leases hinted at the type of ride future visitors might expect. Inquiring spirits were directed to contact Disneyland's Ghost Relations Department. There were rumors among visitors about what had rendered the house off-limits for park guests. Maybe Disney had already tried to open it as an attraction, but the ride had been too terrifying. Perhaps Walt Disney himself was planning to move in and the house would never open as an attraction. In the end, the delays boiled down to something more mundane. Between creating other future favorite rides like Pirates of the Caribbean, breaking ground on a new park in Orlando, and getting ready for the 1964-65 World's Fair, Disney's Imagineers were simply swamped. After Disney died in 1966, finishing the mansion became a focus. A creative debate between the project's 2 driving Imagineers, Mark Davis and Claude Coates, inspired the mansion's complementary moods. Davis was in favor of a lighter, humorous approach to a haunted house. Coates wanted the opposite. The beginning of the attraction is more Claude Coates, his son Alan Coates said. It's scarier, it's more moody, it's darker, it's ominous. You think, uh-oh, this is going to be scary, and it does really frighten a lot of people when they enter those doors. But as the ride's vehicles, called doom buggies, whisk visitors along, the mood starts to brighten. Davis's influence. Spirits dance through the ballroom, and the journey culminates in an upbeat graveyard party. For many fans, it's that combination of fun and frightful that has made the ride a favorite. I think the mansion taps into our wanting to be scared and realizing that we've made it through safely, that we were able to overcome our fears and deal with them and come out okay, Mr. Coates said. Susan Thompson, who lives in Lakeland, Florida, spent her first ride through Disney World's mansion in Orlando as a 5-year-old, crying with her head buried in her mother's side. When she went back a year later, determined to keep her eyes open, she fell in love with watching the mansion come alive. Miss Thompson, now 51, has since acquired her fair share of Haunted Mansion souvenirs, a dress reminiscent of those worn by the mansion staff, and a backpack patterned with the manor's signature wallpaper, among other items. On her twice-a-month visits to Disney World, she always returns to the ride. For R.J. Crowther, Jr., a bookseller in San Diego, the mansion is the first attraction he has a vivid memory of riding at Disneyland. He's since been on it more than 200 times, earning him a certificate from Disney staff that declares him an honorary citizen of the park. Mr. Crowther also collected an, quote, embarrassing amount of mansion merchandise, primarily sculptures inspired by art within the ride. When you're younger, it's all just real magical and real, Mr. Crowther said. There's something wonderfully otherworldly about it that just captures people's imagination. Alyssa Autumn, another superfan, is planning a tattoo sleeve composed entirely of mansion-related images. The exterior of the Disneyland Manor is already finished, and pieces with the mansion's gothic wallpaper and some of the ride's most famous characters are in the works. For the 50th anniversary, Ms. Autumn attended an overnight event at Disneyland, complete with ghoulishly named snacks and photo ops with mansion characters. Tickets went for nearly $300. The Haunted Mansion's fans extend beyond the ride's regulars. It's a favorite among Disney Parks employees, who are called cast members. Everybody that says they want to work for Disney, said Robert Brockler, who was a cast member for 16 years at Walt Disney World in Orlando, 99% of the time they say they want to work at the Haunted Mansion. The work itself isn't extraordinary. Like those at any other attraction, cast members, clad here in green polyester tuxedos and dresses, still spend hours parking strollers in the Florida heat or loading guests into ride vehicles. What sets this attraction apart is how workers acting as the mansion's eerie butlers and maids can melt into their somber, creepy characters as part of the ride's ghoulish aesthetic. If you're having a bad day, oh, that's a great place to be working, Mr. Brockler said. I would just stare at people and just not smile. I'd be like, hey, you work at Disney, you're supposed to smile. No, I'm not. And I would just walk away from them, and it's all a part of the theming. Mansion cast members still find time for more upbeat moments. Mr. Brockler and another employee would sometimes sneak black and white photos of themselves into the picture frames in the ride's ballroom scenes. And when employees at the attraction complete their training, they crawl underneath the doom buggy tracks, flashlights in tow, to sign their names alongside hundreds of others on a wall beneath the ride. Some riders, though, have a different way of leaving a mark. Every once in a while, a cast member discovers gray powder on the floor, the ashes of deceased park-goers who had a particular affinity for the ride, spread by loved ones hoping to add another spirit to the mansion's collection of happy haunts. It was like, oh, somebody spread grandma on the carpet again, Mr. Brockler said. We'd have to shut the ride down and go investigate it. He added, all these people that think that their loved ones are going to be in the Haunted Mansion forever, well, Grandma's getting vacuumed up into a vacuum and getting sent out to a landfill somewhere. But there are plenty of other park-approved memorials at the mansion. Many Imagineers who worked on the attraction were honored in a mock cemetery at Disneyland bordering the ride queue, its gravestones etched with rhyming epitaphs. The cemetery was removed to make room for longer lines, but a similar one remains in Orlando. At peaceful rest lies Brother Claude, planted here beneath the sod, Coates reads. It was a bit too dark for Coates's wife, their son Alan said. She was not a fan. Another Disney employee was immortalized in the ride itself. Madame Leota, the mansion's floating head who summons ghosts from inside her crystal ball, is the face of Leota Toombs, one of Disney's first female Imagineers. Her daughter, Kim Irvine, Disneyland's art director, was a teenager when her mother was practicing for the role. Toombs was the face of Madame Leota, but not the voice, and Ms. Irvine remembers her mother lip-syncing the incantation in front of a mirror downstairs for days. One day, my friends and I came home, and she was down there doing witches and goblins and ghoulies, Ms. Irvine said. They were like, what's wrong with your mom? Toombs did, however, lend her voice to the end of the ride at the California Park, where a small spirit, lovingly called Little Leota by fans, ominously bids visitors adieu. When Toombs died in 1991, Miss Irvine's visits to the ride with her own daughters gave them a chance to hear their grandmother's voice again. I always had to laugh when we would be going up the exit escalator and seeing Little Leota over there going, hurry back, Miss Irvine said, and I'd go, girls, say hi to Grandma. There's Grandma. And I'd hear people around me go, what a weirdo. When Disney decided to create an annual holiday-themed makeover for the mansion, Imagineers needed to record a new incantation for Madame Leota in order to match the overlay. When they approached Miss Irvine for the part, she was initially unsure, but she knew she didn't want anyone else to do it either. Now, every winter, she and her mother are both a part of the ride. I go out in the park in the morning before guests come in to check things out and look things over, and it's so quiet out there in New Orleans before they turn on the music, Miss Irvine said, but Little Leota never turns off. So to walk by the exit there and hear her little voice just talking away to me makes me smile. And our next article is about a movie that's about to be released, if it isn't already. When Good Boys Say Bad Words. The filmmakers behind the new comedy Good Boys about potty mouth sixth graders had to figure out how to handle stars who were too young to actually see the movie. The expletives start early in the new comedy Good Boys. In one of the first scenes, 12-year-old Max, played by Jacob Tremblay of Room, playing in his bedroom, enhances a female video game character to make her breasts larger. Fudge, yeah, he says enthusiastically, except with a much saltier word in place of that fudge. That sets the stage for a raunchy yet sincere movie that feels something like Superbad meets The Sandlot by way of American Pie. Making their feature debuts, Brady Noon and Keith L. Williams star alongside Tremblay as sixth-grade buddies who call themselves the Beanbag Boys. The movie, which opens August 16th, follows them on a one-day adventure that has them spying on high school girls, skipping school, going to kissing parties, and cursing like sailors. It is the latest example of movies that have put naughty language into the mouths of youngsters to comic effect. In the 2010 action comedy Kick-Ass, Chloe Grace Moretz, 11 at the time of the filming, used harsh words and harsher violence when playing Hit Girl, which rankled some critics. In the 2008 comedy Role Models, Bobby J. Thompson spouted expletives like a fountain, and in the 1986 R-rated Stand By Me, its preteens used profanity liberally. Good Boys has plenty in common with that film, but more than its predecessors, it derives considerable humor from the characters' mistaken or uninformed views of sexuality. The filmmakers had to discover for themselves how to handle 11- and 12-year-olds delivering very adult dialogue on risque topics. In some cases, the solutions involved their parents. The movie, which was well-received at the South by Southwest Film Festival in March, comes from the writers Gene Stupinski, 41, who also directed, and Lee Eisenberg, 42. They have known each other for 20 years, writing on The Office and penning the 2011 comedy Bad Teacher. In conceiving the Good Boys screenplay to get the most mileage out of the Kids Say the Darndest Things premise, they remembered what their lives were like when they were their characters' ages. We thought about first kisses, peer pressure, bullying, and all the other stuff we experienced, Eisenberg said in an interview at The Times. Usually, when you see these types of movies, it's the Disney version of it, and we thought, what if it wasn't that? When one of the boys finds a tampon and doesn't know what it is, another boy explains, based on information from an eighth grader, that girls put them in their bottoms to keep their babies from falling out. Or for a joke about a nymphomaniac, one boy supplies a definition, someone who has sex on land and sea. Many of the jokes hinge on adult humor that a kid may be confused by, like a sequence involving a sex doll that the boys think is a dummy for CPR training. So how much did the filmmakers tell their young cast about these scenarios? "We gave them no context," Eisenberg said. "We didn't say to them, this is a sex doll. They would ask questions and we would say, ask your parents." Also, the great thing about having 11-year-old actors is that you can give them line readings that you wouldn't be able to give Daniel Day-Lewis, Stupinsky said. You can tell them, say it exactly like this. The language got cleaner once the scene was over. In a phone interview, Tremblay broke down how he thought about the job. "Max swears, Jacob doesn't," he said. "When I'm on set playing the character, I'm allowed to swear. But when I'm at my house, I'm just Jacob, who's not allowed to swear. When Jacob swears, then he gets grounded." The actor said that he also didn't share adult information that he might have known with the other kids on the set. "We would only talk about inappropriate stuff with our parents," he said, "because some kids don't know certain things, and some kids' parents don't want them to know certain things yet." During the casting process, a few parents were uncomfortable with the language and didn't want their children in the movie, the filmmakers recalled. And one boy would not use swear words during his audition, even though they were in the scene he was reading. "It was like watching the airplane version of your movie," Eisenberg said. Naughty language is a specialty of the film's producers, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, whose scripts for Superbad and This Is the End featured steady streams of profanity. But they said they loved that the screenplay for Good Boys gave greater weight to the childhood crises these kids experienced. There's nothing funnier than stakes that seem really high to the character, but are not in actuality all that high in the grand scale," Rogen said by phone. While the producers helped develop the screenplay, they said they didn't make its language raunchier than what was there originally. "It was already fundamentally in the fabric of the project," Goldberg said. "And it is, in our experience, how kids that age actually talk when their parents aren't looking." While the crude humor is a selling point in the Red Band trailer, Rogen explains to the kids that they're too young to watch the promo, its creators didn't want the movie to get too bogged down in the fact that preteen boys are dropping F-bombs. "As we were editing the movie, we started stripping some of the language away," Eisenberg said. "If it wasn't elevating a joke or feeling like something a kid would say, we thought too much of it would sound like white noise. When we wrote the movie, the goal of it was to make it funny and put the kids in situations that are both relatable and comedically heightened. But hopefully, people like the movie beyond thinking, this kid said, well, this family newspaper can't say what he said." And also from the arts section, girls' quest to sing with Berlin's boys' choir is dashed. A court on Friday blocked a 9-year-old German girl from joining Berlin's oldest cultural institution, its all-boys choir, after she sued to be allowed to sing with the chorus, in a case that pitted a push for gender parity against centuries of musical tradition. Berlin's administrative court said that the choir's artistic freedom is more important than equal treatment in this case. The case had prompted a fierce debate about the difference between the voices of girls and boys at certain ages and the mystique surrounding the tone quality of boys' voices, described as wondrous and natural but utterly transient. But the suit argued that because the choir, the state and cathedral choir, part of Berlin's University of Arts, is a publicly funded cultural institution, its high-quality, intense musical education, voice training, and performance opportunities must be made available to everyone, regardless of gender. Coming months after a leading British soprano, Leslie Garrett, spurred an international debate on gender restriction in the arts by calling for girls to be admitted to the choir of King's College, Cambridge, in England, the German case had reverberated beyond Berlin. Abby Conant, an American trombonist who is now a professor of trombone at the State Conservatory in Trossingen in the Black Forest region of Germany, said that what was at stake in the Berlin case was more than just the right to sing. It was about granting girls the same access to music education that can shape their lives and careers. "While women in classical music have made progress," she added in a phone interview from her home in New Mexico before the verdict, "there is still a gap. I have several male colleagues who were in boys' choirs and had that training and experience performing at a very early age, and that gave them a leg up in their careers, Professor Conant said. The 9-year-old girl, whose identity has been withheld under German law because she is a minor, has a voice that causes patrons in a cafe in Germany to pause when she breaks out in a traditional Christmas carol. She first tried to enter the choir in 2016, but was denied. 2 years later, she again sought entry and was informed in a letter signed by the dean of the music department, quote, "Never will a girl sing in a boys' choir." In March, the choir invited the girl to sing before a selection committee, which again rejected her. It said she lacked the, quote, "high level of motivation and, quote, extraordinary talent necessary to participate in the ensemble," the university said in a statement released by the court. The university further said that the girl's voice did not, quote, "fit the sound sought after for a boys' choir." The university did not respond to a request for comment. The State and Cathedral Choir of Berlin, founded in 1465 by the ruler of Brandenburg, Frederick II, promotes, quote, "free musical education for boys," according to the institution's website. At the time of its founding, girls and women were not allowed to speak or sing in church, so 5 choir boys were chosen to make up the ensemble. Since then, the choir has grown into a public institution that includes more than 250 singers in 11 ensembles who undergo rigorous voice training and perform around the globe. What had not changed in more than 550 years is that it has only accepted boys. Germany's tradition of boys' choirs includes the St. Thomas Choir in Leipzig and the Kirchchor in Dresden, steeped in a tradition that interweaves faith and classical music. Along with the state and cathedral choir, they are all publicly funded. The university's argument that the girls' voice did not fit the boys' choir raised the issue of whether girls' voices sound different from those of prepubescent boys, and if a difference does exist, whether it is audible to the patrons who flock to hear boys' choir at concerts around the globe. In a country that prides itself on a musical heritage that helped define the classical repertoire through the works of Bach and Mendelssohn, both of whom composed for and conducted boys' choirs, high young male voices are viewed as unique and uniquely fragile. Equally important, experts say, is the limited window the boys have to perform before their instruments break at the onset of puberty. But studies have shown that the differences in boys' and girls' voices are so marginal that roughly half of professional musicians could not discern a difference. All girls' choirs exist in Germany, most notably in Cologne, Germany, where an all-girls choir was founded in 1989 as a pendant to the traditional boys' choir, offering them access to an equivalent musical education, vocal training, and the right to perform in the cathedral. Similar programs exist in England. But in Berlin, the girls' choir is only organizationally linked to the state and cathedral choir. The ensemble's website does not advertise a superior musical education opportunity for girls. Instead, there are links to PayPal and details about the foundation that parents can join to support the choir. The girl involved in the lawsuit had been accepted by the Berlin Girls' Choir, but she decided to sing in another ensemble in the German capital, even though it does not have the comprehensive musical education provided to the boys at the State and Cathedral Choir. The girl, who lives in Berlin, first learned about the existence of the boys' choir when she brought home a flyer from her elementary school about the chorus's search for candidates. Her reaction when told that it was only for boys, quote, "That's not fair." She wanted to try out anyway. Recently, the girl sat for an interview in a cafe in Germany. Asked whether she would join the boys' choir if she were allowed, she brightened with a smile and gave a determined nod. But not everyone agreed with her quest. Christian Ahrens, a professor emeritus of musicology who published a study on gender parity in the world's leading orchestras, said that although he supported equal access to music education, integrating boys' choirs was not the way to do it. I am very clearly against what she is trying to do, he said in a phone interview from his home in Berlin. Mr. Ahrens argued that beyond the sound, there is the fact that because boys' voices break at around age 11 or 12, while girls can continue to sing the highest notes up to 15, girls' voices would dominate. In a mixed choir, he said, the girls will have much stronger voices and simply drown out the boys. Okay, we literally have about maybe 3-4 minutes left, so I'm trying to find a short article here. Here's one from the television section. Bill Cosby's appeal begins with sharp questioning by judges. Bill Cosby's effort to overturn his conviction for sexual assault started Monday as his lawyers were pressed to explain the grounds for such an appeal. A panel of appellate judges pressed lawyers for Bill Cosby on Monday to explain why the entertainer should have his conviction for sexual assault overturned at the first hearing prompted by Mr. Cosby's appeal. Mr. Cosby is serving a 3-to-10-year sentence for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constant at his home outside Philadelphia after giving her some pills. His lawyers told a 3-judge panel of the Pennsylvania Superior Court that the trial judge should never have allowed the testimony of 5 other women who said they too had been drugged and sexually assaulted by Mr. Cosby. The prosecution contended the women's testimony showed a series of, quote, prior bad acts that fit the pattern of conduct in the Constand case. But the defense challenged the existence of such a pattern and said the admission of the women's testimony had hurt the presumption of innocence toward their client. Kristen Weisenberger, a lawyer for Mr. Cosby, said the experiences of the 5 women were not sufficiently similar to the Constand case to establish a pattern of prior bad acts as required under Pennsylvania law. In fact, Ms. Weisenberger said their experiences were, quote, different across the board, and to argue their similarity in front of a judge was prejudicial. But Judge John Bender seemed skeptical, asserting that the women's testimony had supported the prosecutor's argument that Mr. Cosby had treated them in the same way that he treated Ms. Constan, a former Temple University employee whose complaint led to Mr. Cosby's conviction on 3 charges of aggravated indecent assault. He gives them drugs, then he has sex with them, Judge Bender told Ms. Weisenberger. That's the pattern, is it not? The trial judge, Stephen T. O'Neill of the Montgomery Court County of Common Pleas, had allowed only 1 additional accuser to testify at Mr. Cosby's first trial, which ended with a hung jury. Adrian Jape, assistant chief of the appeals division for the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office, said the judge had shown restraint in the second trial, by allowing testimony from only 5 of the 19 women that prosecutors had hoped to call as witnesses. During the hearing, Ms. Weisenberger was repeatedly interrupted by questions from the judge as she sought to present several lines of appeal from Mr. Cosby, 82, who was not present. Judge Carolyn Nichols asked Ms. Weisenberger to justify her argument that a statement in 2005 by former Montgomery County District Attorney Bruce Castor, in which he said he would not prosecute Mr. Cosby because of a lack of evidence, represented an agreement that bound his successors in that office. Judge Nichols also said she saw no evidence to support a defense claim that the Judge O'Neill should have recused himself because of defense allegations that there was a history of bad blood between him and Mr. Castor. There is nothing in the record to show that there was any kind of animus between O'Neill and Castor, Judge Nichols said. Outside the court, Mr. Cosby's publicist, Andrew Wyatt, said the introduction of the additional testimony from the women was one sign that his client was not given a fair trial and was instead victimized because he is a wealthy black man. The deck was stacked, Mr. Wyatt said. This was going after a wealthy black man who used his career and his celebrity to humanize all races, all genders, and all religions. Well, that's all the time that we have today. Thanks for joining me as I read from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for the week of Sunday, August 11th, 2019. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day today.